All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Strength Academy Podcast. Mundo here, joined by Grayson.
How's it going, everybody?
So this week we kind of set out to ask the community if they had any questions for us, and we broadcasted that through Instagram. If you have questions, you can also email them to us, but Instagram seems to be like the easiest way to go about it. And we got some good questions and we got some not so great questions. So do you want to go over what we got, Grayson?
Yeah. So we've got, so let's address the inevitable funnier questions first. Mark Larson, my former lieutenant in the Army, asks, which bag of boxed wine makes the best pillow? So for those of you looking for non-weightlifting advice, you can take the bag out of a box of wine and use it as a pillow. And the answer is Franzia makes the best pillow.
Franzia does. Okay, yeah. Okay, because we talked about this. We said that black box wines usually has the best wines.
Exactly.
But their size isn't really conducive to making a pillow out of.
So if you're looking for something to sleep on, Franzia box wine is the best water pillow available. We had a question for Consuelo, which shoe do you put on first? And the answer is unequivocally left.
Yeah, definitely the left shoe first. And I don't know if that's because we're both right hand dominant.
Maybe.
But it's possible that usually you put your left shoe on first.
I'm going to make the objective statement that if you don't put on your left shoe first, you're wrong.
Okay. All right. That's fair.
I'm gonna bear down on that one.
Okay. So, and then TwizWiz3 asked, which is Tyler, asked, when are we doing a super total meet?
So, I've always kind of wanted to do a super total meet, but every time I think about what it would take to set one up, if you wanted it to be a sanctioned event, that's a lot of work to sanction a USAPL meet and a USAW meet at the same time. And then anytime I get excited about, oh, we could do it just like a fun, improvised, super total meet, I think that sounds great. And then I think about how long that would take to run 30 athletes through three attempts on five lifts. And then I don't want to do it anymore.
Oh, yeah, five.
Because that's a 14-hour meet. Like, powerlifting meets sometimes take hours and hours just with three lifts. So I think a super total meet, if done, we will have to coordinate with somebody and do it over 2 days.
Yeah.
A weightlifting meet on Saturday and a powerlifting meet on Sunday. Otherwise, I think it's kind of unsustainable. But then again, if you did it over 2 days, is it a super total?
I don't think so.
Not really.
Like, not really. It has to all be done in the same day. So but that makes for a really long day. Plus, you have to have judges for both. Like that are
qualified judges.
Right, yeah.
And so, the answer is when somebody organizes it
for other than us. Yeah, other than us. Like, we don't necessarily want to do that ourselves. all right, so
okay, so into the meatier questions.
Yeah, these are more legit questions coming up.
So we had a couple of questions about accessory work, and I think that's kind of a fun one to stop in. We had Tyler, not the other Tyler, ask, you know, what sort of movements do you like to focus on for accessory work, and what areas do you think are particularly important for accessory work? So I like to do a lot of, I program a lot of high rep banded things for accessory work. So face pulls, banded upright rows, basically doing multiple heights of face pulls, maybe using the crossover symmetry system for higher repetitions. Because one of the things that I like to do with accessory work is put a lot of focus on to help building up like joint health and connective tissue. And some of that super high rep, you know, 20 to 30 reps per set, can be really beneficial for maintaining joint integrity. So after heavy squat sessions, for example, right now, on days that we're front squatting and loading the knees pretty heavily, I'm having people cool down with, some sets of 30 on like a banded knee extension. If you have access to machines, doing some light weights for high reps might be a way to do that as well. We pretty much use bands because we don't have a whole lot of machinery available. Yeah,
like
weight machines,
like a hamstring
curl
machine, or you know, those types of things, or yeah, a leg extension machine.
So we kind of try to mimic those movements with bands. Areas that I think almost every weightlifter needs to be working on in their accessory work is like upper back strength and the ability to hold the thoracic in extension. I think that's a really important one. And I mean, that's just every kind of rowing, single arm, barbell, reverse grip. I think that you should be prioritizing, you know, you should be rowing or doing some kind of back work at least twice a week, I think.
Yeah.
That's generally how often we're hitting that up. And then I think it's also important when you're talking about accessory work to remember that the highest priority accessory work is squatting. A lot of times we think of it as a primary exercise, yeah, but in reality it's kind of accessory.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I think that like squats, and you can do variations of squats. So what we've implemented now is variations of squats according to depth. So I know that some people will kind of balk at the idea of doing like half squats and quarter squats and things like that. And that's true as long as you're not intentionally doing that.
Yes.
But when you intentionally hit those depths to try to show control and show that you have mastery over the postures that are required to be in those positions at those depths, then that's a different variation of the exercise. So like we've been doing eccentric lowering, like tempo quarter squats and half squats, or at least half squats in the back squat, in addition to a complete back squat. And that's just to be able to build up the ability to power through those sticking points and to be able to maintain an upright position when you hit those levels of depth that cause problems for people, usually like above and below parallel. So that getting to that half squat intentionally and staying there and then coming up out of it is a good way to add some accessory work into your lifts, but also still continuing to build leg strength and power through those ranges of motion that require it when you hit sticking points usually.
Yeah, that's true. In the squatting realm, you're right, we have been kind of playing with more of those partial range of motion squats, yeah, as a way to overload and work on that sticking point. Another thing that I've been doing lately within squatting is varying the stance. So using kettlebells or, you know, barbells, whatever, to work on narrow stance and wide stance squatting based on flexibility limitations. So when you're looking at your accessory work, if somebody's got a really hard time with kind of making space for their hips, maybe doing some wide stance goblet squats at the end just for reps, and thinking of it as, a lot of times your accessory movements can be stretching exercises as well.
Right, yeah.
So if you do 4x10 goblet squats with feet wider than usual, and you're really working on pushing those knees out and creating space for your hips, you're going to be getting kind of a different stimulus than from your normal squat. And if you do it with a tempo, you're loading and stretching, and that's always my favorite combination. That's why I love RDLs and Jefferson curls, because that loaded stretch really, it can improve that range of motion better when you're having to work through it. So yeah, doing some higher rep stuff like that. Also within accessory work is I like to try to get everybody doing single arm and single leg stuff at least once a week. I think that if you can improve your balance on a single leg deadlift or your shoulder stability doing a single arm overhead carry or single arm presses, we get so caught up in doing everything bilateral all the time, because yeah, the sport is basically that.
Yeah, yeah.
That I think it's important to get some single arm stuff and then also some rotational stuff. So Turkish get-ups or TGU sit-ups or Pavlov press or just banded kettlebell or banded rotations and kettlebell windmills. Those are kind of sprinkled in throughout the week. So with your accessory movements, I think the most important thing to focus on is that no two athletes need to do exactly the same accessory movements. A lot of times there are general themes like a weak upper back or yeah, need for improvement in the glutes. But for the most part, if you're designing programs or you're picking accessory work for yourself, make sure you're not picking something because it looks cool, but that it's addressing a specific area. So your accessory work shouldn't be like a breeze at the end. It should be targeted to an area that is difficult for you and that needs improvement.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you know, you're just kind of spinning your wheels a little bit with that.
And I think one thing that we kind of don't specifically add in but should be done almost every day is abs and back. And it doesn't have to be intense. It doesn't have to be like a bunch of sets to failure or anything like that, but something that just addresses some of your core stability work. And that could include breathing exercises as well. So diaphragmatic breathing, the 90-90 breathing that Dr. Quinn Hanuk, you know, recommends in his book, is something that I'm going to start implementing in my lifting, and something that you've already explored in yours as well. But I think breathing exercises, things that address core work, rotational strength. So like when we go back to like the Turkish get-up exercises, that rotational strength, getting up off the floor. We do a lot of bilateral movement, so I agree that the unilateral movement is very important, just to address balance issues and just to provide a different stimulus overall in the training session. And I think, like, yeah, you don't have to go crazy with abs and back, but do something that helps strengthen them just a little bit more every day.
Yeah, a lot of the ways that I kind of encourage people to incorporate some of that is, since that kind of core activation is pretty important for getting into your lifts, so a lot of times when people come in, I'll teach them to warm up with just body weight, 3 sets of 10 hip extensions. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll program that in for the team, and then combining those with some sort of like active abdominal breathing or crunching with breathing, something we call like a toe touch crunch, which is essentially maintaining your low back flat on the ground with your feet in the air and exhaling as you crunch up toward your toes and holding. I like to pair that with the back extension, and it seems, especially for beginners who are just there, where that's the most, to me, that's the most important thing with a beginner, is getting the low back and the core strong enough to maintain position. And getting that activated at the front end is pretty helpful. Staying along with the accessory work, Allie asks, are bicep muscles considered vanity in the sport of weightlifting, or are they actually functional? For those of us that lack strong biceps, is it recommended to train them in isolation using bodybuilding accessory movements? So this is biceps are the double-edged sword.
Biceps are a double-edged sword, yeah.
Because there are some times that I think bicep training is absolutely essential, and that's typically with people with hyperflexible elbows. It's typically going to be women, but I think we've all seen videos of people overhead in the jerk, and it looks like their elbows are bending backwards.
Yeah, yeah.
To me, the bicep exercise for that person is, we need to tighten the elbow up a little bit, so they're at less of a risk of like a dislocation or a strain there.
Yeah, more hyperextension than what they've already got.
Exactly, because there is like, you want to have a great lockout, but there is such thing as, you know, if you're double jointed in your elbows, you're going to have to do more work to protect that joint.
Yeah.
And having a strong bicep muscle is very important for protecting the elbow. That's the other place that I see the importance of bicep training, is that a lot of times our triceps are constantly under load. Anytime we're overhead, we do tons and tons of pressing exercises. And yes, we do pulling exercises, but if you're doing them correctly, your biceps should be helping, not being the prime mover.
Right.
And if you think about the total number of reps we end up doing for triceps versus biceps, if you kind of look at the whole lift together, it's definitely more biased on that tricep side of things. And what I've noticed is that sometimes, you know, if you end up with a little bit of golfer's elbow or a little bit of like tendonitis or pain in your elbows, adding in some hammer curls or some barbell curls at the end of your workout, or maybe even in your warm up, just to get the elbow joint moving a little bit better, I think that's a really, really great application for bicep curls. But I don't think that for weightlifters, I don't think that we should be training them very heavy.
Yeah.
I think that we should be using them to promote blood flow, build up that joint strength like we talked about with the higher rep stuff, but not doing bicep training as a means of balancing out the number of reps that you're doing, but not necessarily making bicep growth the priority of that training, but making elbow health the priority of that training.
Yeah, so I mean, you want to have like an overall balanced set of muscles in your arms. So like you don't want to have, you know, huge Popeye forearms and then tiny bicep muscles. This is, it's not going to be advantageous. But the problem with overworking and getting too much bulk in those bicep muscles is that it prevents you from locking out, and it causes problems with lockout. And it strains the elbow when you're trying to fight against all that musculature to try to lock out in those positions that we're trying to get up into overhead, especially in the jerk. I've seen a lot of people have problems with lockout and complete arm extension in the snatch and the jerk because their biceps are so overdeveloped, and it causes problems for them. And it's not that you don't want to not train them. It's just that you shouldn't train them to the detriment of everything else. Like, it should be in balance. Just like with your accessory work, you're not trying to overwork one muscle group over the other. You're just trying to create a balanced body so that you can create the optimal lifting positions and ranges of motion that you need to get into to perform well.
Yeah, so I think it's important that if you are, you know, training your biceps, that you're also stretching your biceps.
Yeah.
And then for those people who are hyperflexible, using the bicep can help tighten up the elbow joint and help prevent some of that hyperextension. So it really kind of depends on your situation.
Yeah.
But doing it a couple times a week, you know, 30 reps with an empty bar, isn't going to make your arms blow up as far as, you know, hypertrophy right. goes. But it might do some good for just maintaining the health of your elbows. The same can be said of things like wrist extensions and wrist curls. Like, doing it a couple times a week as part of your warm-up. Like, I don't even really think about it as, like, doing it as part of a training. But I'll, you know, supinate my hands and put the bar on, or put my arms on my legs in a squat and just do some wrist curls every now and then as part of a warm-up. And that just kind of helps get everything moving.
Oh, I have a question. So when you do pull-ups, should you be feeling it in your biceps or more in your lats?
So I mean, definitely the lats. I think that a lot of times, and this is why I dislike banded pull-ups.
Right.
Is because a lot of the times when you see people set up a band for pull-ups, they initiate the pull-up with their arms. So they contract at the elbow and then try to get the back to kick on first. So if you're using pull-ups in your accessory work, just like everything else, the technique matters. And if you're trying to develop back strength, you want to make sure that you're initiating that pull-up with a retraction of the shoulder blades and an activation of the back with straight arms first, and then initiate from the arms. Because okay. If you go arms and then back, you end up using a higher percentage of that. And also you end up in kind of a funky position. Like, I think everybody can kind of imagine what it looks like when somebody's doing a real weird banded yeah. pull-up. And that's why I've been a big fan of building your way up to that with, you know, pull-ups with straight arms to work on lat and back activation without engaging the elbow, and being really deliberate with your pull-ups and making sure that you're initiating with the back and not the arms.
Okay. Yeah, because like when I was doing pull-ups this week, I was doing strict pull-ups in my training, and so I kind of thought I was doing it in a weird way, but what I do is I'll grab onto the bar in a grip that's wider than my shoulders, like outside shoulder grip width, and then I'll activate my back by pulling my lats together and then trying to pull my chest to the bar. So I do feel it a little bit in my biceps, but most of it isn't back in my back and lats.
Yeah, and I agree with
but
that.
But it looks like I'm doing a pull-up at an angle. As opposed to like that up and down body position, I look more like I'm at a maybe like a 35 to 20, you know, 30 degree angle, and then pulling my chest toward the bar.
Yeah, and I think that, in my opinion, that's kind of the correct posture that you should be in. If you think about it, that slight angle that you get when you do activate your lats with straight arms is a partial front lever.
Yeah, so, exactly. That's what it feels like.
And I think that's kind of key, because if you think about everything being a progression, the progression for the pull-up might be the lever.
Okay.
Because if you're thinking about gymnastic skills, you have to start with pull-ups. You have to start by activating the right way. And then once your lats are strong enough, they can hold you out at that angle.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I think that, you know, if you look at how is it going to be scaled up, along with pull-ups, don't forget that chin-ups exist.
Oh, yeah.
I love chin-ups. And if you're, looking to strengthen somebody's biceps a little bit more, the chin-up does provide benefits of having some extra bicep focus, but also if you're trying to learn how to do a strict ring muscle up, for anybody still CrossFitting, the chin up looks a lot more like the finish position or the transition position of the muscle up.
Yeah.
And you can get a little bit higher and your hands a little bit lower. And on the rings, your hands are never going to be turned out when you turn over, or they shouldn't be if you're doing a correct strict muscle up. So I also like the chin up as a part of a muscle up progression as well.
Yeah. And then for those of you who aren't sure the difference between a chin up and a pull up are palms away and then chin, palms toward the chin on a chin up.
Yeah.
So it's an easy way to tell.
But yeah, so I think those are all, you know, it's good to train your biceps, but don't overtrain them. And then that accessory work should really be around balance and joint health, rather than just seeing how heavy you can do some dips.
Yeah.
It should be like a pretty fast paced part of the workout.
All right. So let's see. Another question was asked by Beast Diesel D, which is our own, Deanna McGillivray. And, she asked how to balance consistency, practicing movement or skill with movement with variation. So movement variation. So how to balance consistency with variation?
Yeah, this is kind of an interesting question, and we've kind of talked about it a little bit before with, you know, there being kind of two ideas, the extreme specificity side and the lots of variation side. And I think that the most important thing is that you don't want to let you want to keep variation in to keep training interesting and to work on weak areas. I think the purpose of variation is to change up the stimulus. Because if you do one thing over and over again, you get kind of resistant to
right.
it. So by varying the height at which you're starting the lift, varying the type of pull that you're doing, these sort of things can keep you adapting and keep challenging your body. And you kind of stay out of that homeostatic realm where you're continuing to kind of improve. But I think that when you're selecting for variations, you want to be careful not to get too far away. So an example of like stuff that I think is kind of too far away is when you see super, super high rep complexes.
Like a bear complex?
Like a bear complex is a really good example. So power clean, front squat, jerk, back squat, behind the neck jerk, or push press. I don't remember which one it is.
Yeah, it's whatever.
But I think that, you know, if you're super far away from a meet or if you're just doing it for fun, that's a pretty good, that's a fun exercise.
Sure, yeah.
But, you know, you don't want to drift too far away from the lifts, though. So if it ends up being a time frame that's outside of the time frame of a usual lift, right? So if you're working for a minute and a half straight because you did 4 deadlifts, 3 hang snatches, 2 snatch balances, and 1 overhead squat, you probably got a little bit stronger from doing that, but your skills weren't exactly honed.
Sure.
So I think people go overboard with complexes for use of variation. Like, just remember that a snatch pull plus a snatch is a complex.
Right.
And that is a variation.
Yeah.
With squatting, you don't need to do banded kettlebells hanging off the edge of your squat to change variation. A variation in the squat can be normal stance, wide stance, narrow stance, halfway down with a pause.
Right.
Those are all variations, but they still stick very close to the lift. If you're doing banded snatches or like bamboo bar snatch balances, it might be a novel training effect. It might be fun, but it might be kind of too far out of that realm of this doesn't really look like what we're trying to do. What are your thoughts on this?
So, well, I have two thoughts. Number one is like human beings are a lot like bacteria, right? If you keep introducing the same elements into it, it's going to adapt and become resistant to it.
Yeah.
And so you want to provide enough stimulus and training with variation to continue to provide stimulus, but you don't want to over introduce too many stimuluses because you won't know what's adapting and what's not. So I think that when we're trying to build consistency overall with the lifter, we're practicing movement and skills that are building onto the consistency of the classical lifts. And that's what we're trying to build up toward, even with movement variation. So like if we are doing complexes, we're doing the pull plus a snatch. And those are both building onto the proficiency of the classical lift. So like you're getting better at snatching by doing variations of snatching. But overall, I think that when people try to introduce too many things at once, like if you have a bunch of different complexes and you don't get a chance to repeat them. So like if every week you were changing complexes, that wouldn't be a good way to address movement variation, because you wouldn't be building consistency. You have to have the ability to repeat what you were doing before to provide that stimulus to know what's working and what's not. So I think that it's also not just what you introduce, but how often you introduce it and how often you change it. So it's important that if you're doing an exercise 1 week, that you should be able to have the ability to try to improve upon it next week. So that way you know that you are getting better at it, the stimulus is working, and that you're getting more proficient at what it is that you're trying to accomplish in that exercise. So for me, I think it's really a matter of balancing, introducing the right amount of variation, and then allowing you to be able to build proficiency and consistency within that variation, and then moving on to another exercise that built on what we already had. So I think it's important to kind of like have an idea of where you want the training to go and end up, as opposed to just saying, oh, we're just going to do this week, and then we're going to do this next week. And then, so like, I know when we put together training programs and we put together programming, we have an idea of where we want things to head with the direction of it. So then we build our training around those ideas. And then eventually you get to the point where hopefully the culmination of all these different practices and movement variations are building onto a better snatch and clean and jerk.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that kind of some practical advice for that is, you know, you mentioned sometimes people change up the exercise every week.
Right.
And I think that's too much variation.
Yeah.
For us, generally speaking, we'll do the same movements for maybe 3 weeks, and then have a deload week and a change of exercise for the following block. I think I like that approach a lot, because week one is generally much lighter. And to me, you know, when I introduce a new exercise, I think of week one is learn what that feels like. Mm-hmm. Week two is build up in weight, and week three is push it on it.
Yeah.
And that way it's your third exposure when you start really, like, maybe it's up, you know, 65% to learn, 70% to load, and then 75% and really go to hard
maximize
on it.
Yeah, to maximize the exercise.
And that's kind of how I think about it, is that I like that three exposures. It seems like anecdotally, like, that's the right number for people to, for it to click in that third week. Because usually in the first week, it's choppy and unfamiliar. In the second week, it's looking good and they're moving some better weights. And then by the third week, they feel at home enough with that position to really push it for the workout.
Yeah.
And when I've tried doing, you know, a bigger rotation or like different things every week, people are exposed to more movements, but it just seemed like there wasn't that skill development alongside it.
Right.
So I think that, you know, you want to vary your exercises, but you don't want to vary them too often. Like if you are just power snatch and then snatch balance the next week and then hang snatch the week after, it's going to be so long before you see that exercise again that you might not achieve a certain amount of mastery over that movement. So I think that, you know, keep your variations simple. Don't overly complicate things. Keep them different enough to be interesting and to challenge the positions you need, but don't vary things for the sake of varying things.
Right. Yeah, just because you're bored. Like,
yeah.
That's not a good way to approach it. Like if you're trying to use variance as a oppositional tool to boredom, then you're definitely on the wrong track. I think that variation is to provide a stimulus for adaptation. It's not to satiate your boredom.
So, you know, if you're looking at your program that you found online and it's, you know, like tens in the squat in the first week, and then threes the second week, and then fives the third week, and then, you know, you're all over the place.
Yeah, it's real weird.
It's, you know, that's kind of a, there needs to be a little bit more of a plan to those things, and changing things up just to change them up might provide novel stimulus, might make you a better CrossFitter, but won't reinforce the skills that you want within weightlifting. So this kind of leads into a question from Desa, which is, what should new athletes look for when joining a weightlifting gym or team? So what are the sort of things that new athletes should be looking for? Because, you know, there are more clubs coming around. There's opportunities to train. There's even, you know, 24-hour fitness has bumper plates and platforms now. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So if you're looking to start an online program or join a local club, what are some things that, you know, athletes need to be looking for? And I think that the first one needs to be that when you show up, there should be a clear emphasis on technique overload. If you're a new person coming into the gym, the, you know, first thing should be like the coach should explain, like, this is the technique and these are the things that we're going to expect of that technique before we introduce load. I think that's a hallmark of a good gym, is placing a big emphasis on learning to do things correctly rather than saying, can we do 10 more pounds next week?
Yeah.
You know, generally speaking, and not everybody does it the same way that we do, but, you know, I like to not have new people max out for 3 months, maybe, most of the time.
Yeah, usually.
It's usually kind of working by feel. We don't really do percentages for their lifts. It's just get really good at snatching 40 and 45 kilos, and then we can do 50. And then at the end of the first cycle, then we let them kind of go up and test. But, you know, you want to look for... You want to feel like there's an assessment being done. So if you come in and they just give you the team workout and don't do any modifiers for it, or, you know, don't take a look at how do you squat?
Yeah.
That's another one. Is
the basics,
the basics.
How well do you air squat? Like, and so, okay. So when I think about, so the question is what do you look for when you're trying to go to a new gym or find a place to work out and things like that, right? So if I wasn't talking about weightlifting, right, and I'm a new person and I'm going to join, let's say I wanted to join a new jiu-jitsu gym, right? I approach it the same way as if somebody's coming into my gym. Like, I want to explain to them what the process entails. I want to show them that we have all the necessary equipment to fulfill their training needs and guide them through the process. Now, if at any point I get left alone to do, stuff on my own, and I don't have any clue what to do, like, I don't know what I don't know, that's not a good feeling. Like, I don't like walking into a new gym and then just being like, oh, well, there's the barbell, there's the plates, go ahead and warm up and we'll figure out what you're going to do in a little bit. It's like, I don't want to do things like that, like, because I don't know what to do. Like, I don't know how to warm up. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. So if I'm a brand new person, I kind of want to be guided through the process. I know that's a lot of hand-holding and a little bit of babysitting required on, you know, the coach's part, but I don't want to show up to a gym or, you know, like in this case, in this scenario, like a jiu-jitsu place and be like, well, I don't know anything about jiu-jitsu. And they're just like, go ahead and start warming up. We're going to go ahead and start the class in like 30 minutes. And I don't know how to warm up. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm looking around, watching what other people are doing. And it's like, what am I supposed to be wearing? Like, how am I supposed to warm up? Like, what kind of drills are they doing to warm up? So, like, it's important that when you're new and you haven't trained before, that if when you go to a gym, that the coaches are walking you through the process. Because let's say you haven't done any barbell sports before, and you don't know how to warm up, or you don't know what you don't know. So you kind of, it's important for you to be guided through that process. Like people forget what it's like to be new. And sometimes we just assume that they know everything that we know. So I think as a new person, you have to look for somebody that's willing to guide you through the process and be patient with you. And that does have an emphasis on doing things the right way to start off with. So it's very important that you learn how to move well and get mobility and ranges of motion and technique before you start loading the barbell heavy. So the first day, if you show up to a gym, they're like, all right, let's go ahead and max out and see what you got. Like, probably not the best approach, especially if you don't know much about lifting or you haven't done it in a lot of years. If you're not coming from CrossFit or if you're not coming from some other kind of barbell sport, it's important to kind of make sure that people are guided through the process of what they're going to be, encountering day to day.
Yeah. So when we get new members that have some weightlifting experience, my favorite way to kind of assess things is, let me see your current barbell warm up.
Yeah.
Let me see you do 70% a couple times, because usually you can kind of tell if there's some technical errors there.
Right.
So my assessment for a beginner who's just absolutely brand new is, here's how you breathe, here's how you squat, here's what these positions are. And it's a lot of, it takes us a little bit of time to get into doing, the full stuff. But if somebody's got a couple of years of experience, but they're just coming from another club or moving into town, typically it's, let me see you overhead squat, let me see you do a couple snatches in a medium percentage range. And then based on what I see there, I, decide where we need to start that person and what the most important things are within that. Another thing to look at is, what's the culture of the gym?
Yeah, like, exactly. The environment matters.
Does it feel welcoming when you come in? Does it seem like people are... Well, really, does it just match what you want? Because there are going to be some clubs that are a lot more raucous and a little more like, people having fun and being loud and kind of doing that stuff. And then there's going to be more gyms that are more reserved and serious. And what matters is not what style of gym it is, but whether that jives with you as a person.
Right.
So if you come in and the coach is very militant and shouts at you all the time, and that's just not what you like, find a gym that is more of a conversation.
Sure.
There's a lot of different styles, and all of them work for the same people.
Right.
So if you're going into a gym, you want to be a place that you feel comfortable with that coach, you feel comfortable with that team. If people are accosting you at the gym, like that's something that you want to consider. Whether or not it seems like there's like a team or a community built up there, or does it seem like everybody's got their headphones in and nobody talks to each other? And you might like one more than the other, and that might work for you. So you want to get a feel for the environment too. What does it feel like to be in that place? Because sometimes you'll thrive, like even if it's, a little bit of a different approach than we described in how we start new people, does it seem like there's a system in place that has developed people before?
Right.
And
right.
Then if you're looking to compete at a high level, it's not always the case because everybody starts somewhere. But like, are other people doing the thing that you want to do there?
Right. Exactly.
And you can, even as a beginner, you can kind of look around and see like, who've been here a while look pretty good?
Yeah.
Does the technique look like it's coming together? And I think that's one way that you can kind of look at that, is if, you're seeing something that you know is an error and all that that person's getting is a good job, then that might not be this place for you. So like it depends on how much feedback you want, how seriously you want to take it, whether you jive with the coaches and the community. I think all of those things, matter a lot. And I think that another important thing with interacting with a new coach is, I love when people ask me questions about why am I doing this. And if the answer is because I said so, for me personally, that's kind of if you can't explain to me why I'm doing something, do you know why I'm doing this?
Right.
So I think that, being in a place that you feel comfortable asking questions leads to better, athlete investment. I want people to say, oh, why am I doing a 3-position snatch? And it's like, oh, well, because we're building complexity. We're starting here. We're working on transitioning and we're working on building on that.
Right.
So I think that, if you're just starting out and you don't understand why you're doing something, ask that question. And if that's not taken very well, to me, that's kind of an example of, well, maybe I don't want to be in that situation.
Right. And another thing is, as an athlete, if you can't take criticism and feedback and you don't want to have a continuous feedback loop, then you probably aren't going to thrive under a coach. in general, because that's what they're there for. And Grayson and I had this discussion, and I'm probably going to write a blog article about it, but basically, like, why coaches matter, what they're supposed to do, and why they're involved in the process. Why do people get coaches to begin with? And the reason is because, like, as an athlete, you need feedback. And to put it simply, is like, we're the worst observers of ourselves. And even when we record ourselves on video, that's not real-time feedback. Like, it's easy to notice mistakes in a video when you're playing it back, but if you can get feedback in real-time, that's part of that coaching process. So, like, as an athlete, you have to be willing to take that criticism as well and be open to being part of that feedback process, both with the coach and with yourself, and being open to being part of a community. Because sometimes your peers will also notice things, and they'll be like, hey, you're doing this in your start position, were you aware of it? And you're like, you know, don't worry about me, worry about yourself. If that's your attitude, you're probably not going to thrive in that kind of team environment. So, like, it really matters your approach and your attitude toward training as well. So I think that Grayson's definitely, like, the type of coach that's willing to explain the things and sit there and answer questions and things like that. So, like, if you're interested, he'll tell you. And
if anything, I'll get worked up and talk for 15
minutes.
Yeah,
yeah, then you might get cold.
That was too much. but yeah, and I think that, you know, so are you getting feedback?
Feedback is important.
Yeah. So, and whether, and what style that feedback comes in, whether it's a, you know, what did that feel like? Tell me about it from your perspective, and then I'll tell you what I saw. Or it's a...
Or Klokov punching you in the nose because you're putting your head through too far on the jerk.
Yeah, so there's all of these different styles of coaching. I mean, you just have to find one that jives with you.
Right.
But if you're not getting any feedback, then that's a sign that that person's not paying attention to you.
Right.
And
it's like texting. If they're not sending anything back to you, you're getting ghosted.
So those are some of the things that I'd look for if you're looking for a new gym or team. Environment, are people performing at the level you want to perform? Does it seem like there's an emphasis on learning to do things really well? Do they talk about it as a process rather than an event?
Right.
Like, is it, let's hit this workout hard today, or let's get really good over 2 years? And I think those are kind of different outlooks. And so that's a couple of the things that
That pretty much, like, sums up what we think about joining new gyms and stuff like that. So hopefully that answers that question. We're at 42.
Perfect. Yeah. We got time for a couple more.
Yeah.
All right. So this is kind of a juicy one. So I think this might be kind of fun. So this one comes from Gary. Thoughts on steroid use?
Oh, no.
Let all athletes use under medical guidance, or continue with the system that we currently have? This is a devil's argument, devil's advocate thing fairly regularly. And I think we've heard a lot of different analysis on this. So let's try to air some stuff on both sides and see where we come down.
All right. So I'll argue both sides, but I'm going to start off with I'm for the idea of allowing athletes to take performance-enhancing drugs under the supervision of a doctor. Number one, because a lot of the time when athletes do end up using these performance-enhancing, you know, drugs and supplements and things like that, they're just taking them willy-nilly off the store shelf, from the black market, things like this, and from their local dealer at Define Fitness. And they don't know the purity, the sourcing of the substance. They don't know the history of use of the substance and things like that. They just take it and they're just hoping for the results that they want. But if you're taking it under the supervision of a doctor, they can take blood samples. I mean, and they can do lab tests and things like that to make sure that everything's functioning properly and that you're not dying, you know,
in the process of taking 10 years off your life.
Exactly. So in that aspect, I think that it would also control the dosages and things like that athletes take. And so that if everybody's doing this and everybody has the opportunity to do this, it levels the playing field, right? On the other hand, if you have the idea of, like, clean sport where nobody should be taking anything, then all you're trying to do is catch the outliers. because what happens is that people are going to do things regardless. And we've gotten hundreds of doping violations in the sport from, I don't know, since when they started doing testing. Like,
I mean, it's always, we've reshuffled the weight classes 3 times because of that.
We've had to reestablish world records. We've had to reestablish weight classes, and we've gone back and taken medals away from athletes from previous Olympics because they've been tested and then retested their samples 10 years later with new methods and then found out they tested positive. So instead of taking things away from these athletes because they weren't clean at the time, if everybody was allowed to, under the supervision of doctors, I mean, they could still make the choice not to compete that way. That's fine. But like saying that everybody's going to compete clean and then not testing everybody all the time kind of eliminates the ability to say that the sport really is clean, because you do have people that are outliers or that from other countries that do have state-sponsored programs that are doing this under doctor supervision. And then when they come to compete at national or international events, then they're obviously like scooting by under the radar. Or even if they win, they're already like tapered off whatever they were on. So it's like our sport has a history of a symbiotic relationship with performance enhancing drugs. Like the idea of getting stronger and then using other substances to increase that strength has been synonymous with barbell sports since they began.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, it's the absolute prime candidate, because, you know, taking a certain number of PEDs and getting stronger but playing football might have a lot less, like, you might perform a little bit better, but there's going to be a direct correlation if you take something that just makes you stronger without having to do as much.
Right.
It's a perfect candidate for, like, you know, using that, because it just is going to improve that performance.
Right.
So I kind of think I can see the argument for, well, we're having all of these doping violations. No matter how advanced our tests get, people get better at evading them.
Right.
Always somebody is cheating. So letting everybody do whatever they want would kind of fall in line with, like, it's a level playing field. But where I have a problem with that, and why I think I lean a little bit more towards improve anti-doping measures globally the same way that we've improved them in the U.S. Because, I mean, at AO2, they tested people in the H session.
Right.
You know, there was a huge amount of testing going on. And I think if that we can, that best case is instituting that worldwide. And the reason I feel that way is, I understand the argument of these are legal adults. They're trying to pursue this. They don't care about anything other than achieving the highest success in this.
Right.
So why not let them do whatever they want? As a spectator, it might be more fun. You get to see more 500-pound cleaner jerks. But on the other hand, there's always going to be people that prefer not to take that risk. And to say that you have, it would basically turn into, if we let everyone do it, it would become a requirement for senior international competition.
Right. Yeah.
So there would just be no room to not do it. And then we'd end up in a situation like powerlifting, where there are tested and untested meets.
Or federations, you know, split.
Yeah, or in NASA, where there's different categories for lifetime drug free and 3 months drug free. Yeah. Like, there are so many subdivisions in there, and I think that creates a lot of red tape. And the other area that I feel like, well, on the, you know, I'm supportive of the libertarian argument of you're an adult, do whatever you want, we shouldn't regulate what you put in your body.
Right.
Where that gets risky to me is thinking about youth and junior lifters.
Yeah.
Because if it's, this is what I know everybody at the senior level is doing, there's going to be a higher increased chance of 14 and 15 year olds wanting to go on drugs to like get better toward their senior careers. And then there's also the risk of, if you do train a kid drug free to a certain point, sitting him down when he's 20 and saying, now you have to start buying testosterone and injecting yourself in your kitchen every morning. Like, I think that, by trying to make it so that nobody's bothering you about what you're putting in, and we're just trying to chase biggest performance, what we're actually kind of doing is forcing people's hands who wouldn't have otherwise chosen to do that to say, if you want to continue to be a weightlifter, you have to go on Dianabol. And I think that that's the risk.
Yeah, and I think that's a good case because we've seen that happen in other sports too, like baseball especially. Like there was one guy, I think his name was Tony Bosch, but he got busted for basically providing performance-enhancing drugs to teenagers, to high school baseball players. And so, like, there is a line, and I think that line is definitely, like, minors. Like, but I see the problem. Like, if they are trying to get to the level that a lot of people are aspiring to, which is competing at the highest level possible, which is the Olympics or even, you know, Worlds and things like that, the steps that are necessary to get there under that scenario, they would be required to hop on board with that. And I don't think that's a good thing for the sport or for them as individuals either. So yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe it's just better off, you know, the way it is. But if you don't want to compete, you always have that option.
Well, and so that's where I have kind of I'll stake my controversial claim on this one, is that while I think that performance-enhancing drugs should be banned from competitions, and you know, we should really crack down and take it seriously. If you cheat, you cheated.
Yeah.
And you know, handle that accordingly. And I think we're doing a good job of that. And I'd like to see everybody else kind of catch up to where the U.S. and Japan and Germany and some of these other countries that... I think in Germany, if you fail a test, it's a lifetime ban.
Oh, wow. Like,
okay. You're out. And I think that, you know, taking it more seriously will help with that. But on the other hand, I don't think that they should be illegal for a bro in a Globo gym who just wants to look a certain way.
Sure, yeah.
So, like, I think that there's... like, the idea that, you know, these things are illegal despite them not having like a addictive quality, or like you know, if nobody cares if that guy's doping,
yeah,
to do like 70-pound cheat curls and just have huge arms,
right.
So I think that our kind of American idea of being really against cheating in sports trickled into the society in general, where now people think it's cheating at looking better. I don't really think that there's cheating in looking
really
better.
You can't cheat at looking
like
better.
If you're vain and you want to spend a bunch of money to get real huge on drugs, I think that should be within your rights, but I don't think you should be allowed to compete in that state.
Yeah, yeah. Like, if you want to take testosterone and look like Sylvester Stallone at 50, like, that should be your choice. You should be able to do that. But if you want to be 50 and look like Sylvester Stallone and compete in weightlifting, like, maybe that's not, like, that's
it's
not your
kinda
area.
It's kind of unfair to everybody, yeah, that doesn't have the money to drop on it, right, or, you know, for people that actually care about their livers.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of the distinction for me, is I think that for your average person who just wants to look a little better, or, like, you know, just has it in their head that they want 17-inch arms.
Sure.
Now, you know, you can kind of try to get that in there. But I think for competition, just because of how it'll percolate down to the youth ranks,
yeah,
and, you know, interfere with those people who also want to be healthy and compete.
Right.
I think that, it's best if we just continue to reinforce what we're doing now and trying to catch people cheating, and just knowing that sometimes we won't, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think you changed my mind. Like, maybe that's not the best solution. Like, the doctor, state-sponsored type thing. Like, just because of the youth aspect, because of how it would affect them, like the next generation of lifters. Like, it wouldn't be good for them.
That, and it could create like an arms race. So if there's, you know, sanctioned, like, ooh, we can do performance-enhancing drugs, then you'll have pharmaceutical companies racing to make better and better drugs.
That's true too.
And I think it'll just escalate to a point that there might be unknown health consequences of trying to develop new manipulators for those sort of things. So I think it could get out of hand, because I think, you know, you see like the SPF and like real, you know, geared pharmaceutically powerlifting federations and
like Westside Barbell type
it's
stuff.
Just a ton of guys that are purple from how high their blood pressure is.
Yeah, they're like bleeding out of their nose when they're doing squats and deadlifts, like,
yeah,
like just it, real red.
It might not be like the healthy, like it, looking at sports where it is unregulated like that, I don't know if I want to see weightlifting turn into that.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I agree.
Let's see. We got time for one more?
I don't
more?
Know if we have time for one more. We're at 55 right now, so maybe we should just close it out and maybe save some of these for next
A couple of the ones left over will definitely take a little bit more time, but there's definitely some good stuff in there.
Yeah.
So thank you guys for sending in your questions. I hope that was a little bit of a change up from our usual routine. I appreciate everybody who answered the Instagram surveys and got us some questions. We're going to be trying to get a couple of other guests on for you guys. We've got a handful of people we're trying to line up. And, we'll continue to... Maybe we'll do one of these shows every month. I think the Q&A session
is... I like the Q&A, too. And I think that for the future, I'll put some more questions out and hopefully get some more responses. But I appreciate the people that did submit questions, even the silly ones. We'll take time to answer those too, but we're hoping to have some guests coming up in the future. One of them being a psychology professor, another one being just an old time, like one of the OG powerlifters, and then some people that have just had a breadth of experience in the sport as referees, as a lifter, and going all the way from the beginning of the sport. I mean, people with USAW numbers in the single digits, probably.
At least triple digits.
It's triple digits, yeah, yeah. So, so we're going to try to build some more shows, some more entertaining aspects of the podcast for you guys. And we appreciate all of you who have been listening up to this point. And we'll try to develop and continue to build the show and make it into something better that you guys can get something useful out of, or at least some entertainment out of. And we appreciate it. If you have any questions outside of what we already asked, you can send them to asaweightlifting@gmail.com or DM us at Albuquerque Strength Academy in Instagram. And as always, we are appreciative of you guys listening, and we hope that you got something out of this episode.
Guys, subscribe and rate the podcast. It really helps us show up in search results a little bit more. If you like what you hear, and write us a review or an email, reach out, and until next week, guys, live with no regrets.
All right, catch y'all later.